This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
We are often guided by imageries that we have when we don't know each other, right, in detail. So at the workplace, it's very easy to, when you're meeting colleagues, you know, in cursory passes, to just imagine what they are capable of based on their looks. I mean, purely based on their looks, right? And this would include, you know, your race, age, gender. And it's only when you get to know a person, right, then all those stereotypical expectations are stripped off, and then you are finally seeing each other for who, you know, who the person really is.
That was Professor Pauline Tay Strong explaining what stereotyping means. Prof Strong is a sociologist and Dean of Students at the Singapore Management University. She joins us today to talk about something we all do at work, stereotyping. What is stereotyping? How does it affect our workplaces? What do we lose or gain when we apply stereotypes to our colleagues or potential co-workers? Welcome to the 28th episode of Work Talk, a podcast series to help you work smarter, think deeper, and get ahead in your work life. I am Chris Bull, and this week, besides Prof Strong, I'm joined by a special co-host.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Tiong. I'm a young professional in internal communications and employee engagement. Today's topic is right up my alley, and I'm excited.
So, let's get started.
So, Prof, I want to ask you, building on this idea of stereotype, I was wondering, how do you define a stereotype versus, say, a demographic trend?
Thank you very much for that, Jonathan. The difference is, I think a stereotype is not derived from evidence, right? It is derived from impressions, and oftentimes prejudicial impressions. That's why they stick, right? It's newsy, it's sticky because, you know, it has that gossipy kind of flavor, right? But in terms of studying, you know, seriously, trends, changes, right? It tends to be more evidence-based, right? So we see a trend because we see the statistical notes shifting. So a trend has to be observable, is rendered visible through evidence most of the time.
I also asked Isaac Lim what he thinks. Isaac is a sociologist focusing on work and organizations. He is also the founder of Anthro, a human insights and research consultancy.
My idea of stereotypes are more cognitive, and I think of them as essentially heuristics.
Heuristics are mental shortcuts for us to solve problems and make judgments quickly.
For example, when we buy fruits at a supermarket, right, we look at colour, we like to press the fruits, we pick up and smell them, and then we convince that, ourselves that the fruit is sweet or ripe or fresh based on certain characteristics that's in front of us. So there's uncertainty there. We're never quite sure whether the fruit is as we believe. But these shortcuts allow us to navigate the task of buying fruits. Yeah, because our brains like to be efficient.
So when our brains want to be fast and pack people into boxes, what happens?
So this is particularly frustrating in the workplace because we're talking about, you know, older persons, for example, right? A simple, you know, connection like an older person, so somebody who is 65 years old in 1990 is not the same as somebody who is 65 in 2024. In 1990, when you're 65, the expectation that at 65, you would be retired and you would be possibly hopping on to grandparenting roles and responsibilities. But in 2024, at 65, most would not think of retiring or hope not to retire because they're still well and they still want to be able to contribute meaningfully. And, you know, somebody who was in 65 right now is caught up in this narrative of, you know, 65 is the new norm, right? You know, so, you know, therefore, you know, they would also expect differently of themselves, right? So if we continue to put people in these, you know, stereotypical boxes, in short, we are not progressing. We're not catching up with the times and we're losing human potential. That's the saddest thing, I feel.
Prof calls herself a dreamer and Isaac a doer. We asked Isaac how stereotyping plays out in real life.
My clients worry quite about a few things that's related to stereotypes. They worry about the gap between Gen Z and older workers. Some are worried about female representation at the more senior levels. A small portion is worried about occupational stereotypes. And currently, for example, we're working on a project to help improve the quality and quantity of jobs for people with disabilities, or PWDs for short. As we all know, we have a problem of underemployment as well as unemployment for PWDs. And I think this has got to do with stereotypes of what PWDs can or cannot do. The first thing that comes to many people's mind about a PWD is someone on a wheelchair. But people with disabilities are really quite a spectrum of different kinds of disabilities.
So actually, it's the power of socialization that pushes us that way. See, I mean, let's say if you've been socialized in an environment where there is racial prejudice, right? You could meet 10 persons of minority status, 9 of them working very hard, but one loafing under a coconut tree. You only register that one because it's familiar. It's familiar because the narrative has been drilled into us, right? So in that sense, you know, with persons of disabilities, with older adults, with other vulnerable groups, that's the problem we are facing now, isn't it? Like, we are acting on outdated stereotypes and we are not allowing ourselves to see beyond.
My question for Isaac, as well as Prof, building on this idea of socialization, is when companies are trying to combat bias, stereotyping, and so on, they might try different kinds of interventions, diversity training, awareness talks. But in your experience, what kind of interventions are more effective and less effective given this concept of socialization?
I think that's a very good question, Jonathan. I think we're at the point where we are paying lip service. So a simple example, we are paying lip service to extended longevity and how we should leverage the older workforce. That's not enough. Because what is enough is if we look at the strengths of those who are post-55, for example, okay? And they are definitely going to be different from people who are younger, like yourselves, John, right? So how can we then say that, you know, young or old, it doesn't matter, same, you're just one in numeric fact, you know, figure in the labor force. This generation of older adults is very different from the generation of post-50s in the 1960s or 1970s. What are their strengths? And then we should then transform the workplace and hire based on capabilities and place them where they can contribute significantly. And it's the same with persons of disabilities, right? We assume that persons of disabilities cannot function in the workplace. I mean, maybe that was true when interventions were not as robust 20 or 30 years ago. But certainly now we see more and more persons of disabilities in higher education, you know, in skills training and enhancement. And therefore, rather than say, oh, persons of disabilities, so what can we do? We cannot think like that. We have to now look at, you know, what they can bring to the table and then tell ourselves that how can we best use them? Right, so that requires really a transformation of how we hire, the roles and responsibilities and the positions that we have.
Change is hard. Why can't bosses stay the way they are?
So an employer had asked me, why should I do all that? Why would prefer to just continue to do what I do? And, you know, so I wasn't quite so rude in my reply, but I had said that, well, you can't do it because you have no choice. We have no choice because our TFR is now below 1.
TFR is the total fertility rate. It's at 0.97.
If you want to survive in Singapore, you know, and to continue to thrive in our, you know, amazing, you know, ecosystem, right, that is a safe and, you know, reliable kind of infrastructure for businesses, then you have to learn how to make use of the capabilities and the talent that we have. If you're an employer, you cannot rely on, you know, foreign labor from the region, simply because, you know, our own gateways, gatekeeping aside, simply because the region is also aging. And therefore, it will be a matter of sooner than later when we find that this surplus foreign labor talent pool will dry up for us.
There are many organizations that implement diversity training programs, and many of them intend to reduce this thing called unconscious bias and among their employees and their managers. However, the research out there shows that it doesn't really work. And the study tells us that these training programs are often very limited in effecting any change or improving diversity outcomes. In fact, the study also shows that these training sessions can actually sometimes backfire or lead to resistance and defensiveness among the participants of the programs. Because in a way, you're telling people that you are inherently racist, sexist, or whatever, right? So they have a reaction.
So what is effective?
Interventions that are structural in nature, changing organizational policies, practices to address the root causes of inequality and discrimination. So things like recruitment processes, putting in place mentorship programs with very clear diversity goals, and going beyond this business case argument of why we should do this or do that. But you may ask why? Because these problems are systemic. And these training programs are trying to tackle a systemic problem from an individual effort point of view. So we're bound to lose. Systemic problems require systemic solutions. Okay. Now, you also ask about questions about, does having a more diverse workforce help organizational performance, financial performance, and so on? So there is quite a bit of evidence out there to show that diversity increase and improve performance. But I think we need to ask why. Why does diversity help? And this is the part that is not properly addressed in many of these programs. Diversity helps because there is a diversity of thought. You bring robustness in discussions of difficult topics. When you have different people of different age groups, people of different training, people of different gender or different country coming together, they cover each another's blind spots. The reason why there's so much talk about board diversity is because the board governs the senior management, and they should be able to cover the blind spots and bring different perspective and robustness in thinking. But unfortunately, what has happened so far is that we did not go beyond things like gender. We have a gender proportion thing that's going on, but beyond that, we don't really go and take a look at things like age, for example. We don't take a look at training. There's insufficient attention that's paid to that. So having a seat at the table is different from having a voice at a table. And having a voice at a table is different from having your voice actively incorporated into decision-making. We've all been to meetings where you can say all you want, right? You know it's not going to matter because the person making a decision is not going to incorporate our ideas. So over time, you just keep quiet. So that is when you can have on paper all the diversity metrics met. But the process in which that diversity is supposed to materialize into benefits for your organization is not materializing because of how conversations are being held.
Yeah, I mean, I personally also relate to that. And I think most of us who have ever worked a job would relate to that. So what can we do as individuals or at the organization level?
We've come to the point where, you know, we keep mouthing that we want, you know, we are living in an inclusive society. And that inclusivity must include fair engagement at the workplace. Simple as that, right? So Jonathan raises an important question. We really need transformation in HR and workplaces, because a lot of times our HRs are not doing what we expect them to do, which is to leverage human capital. HR tends to function like policemen, you know, like, you know, you encounter HR when, you know, you cross some line, fill some form wrongly, and then they'll come to you and say, hey, you have broken the rules, okay? You've taken more leave than you're required, and all that. So we tend to see HR as policemen, which is a waste of an HR. A good HR must be one that looks at what the company is committed to do, right, in terms of its outcomes, okay? And then look within at the labor pool that the company has and see how each person and each division can be maximized to their potential in terms of their strength and contribution. And you can only do that if you give these persons a voice to tell you their experiences on the ground. So these kinds of organizations will succeed. The others will not. But the problem is the organizations that do not put these good practices in place, they manage to survive because, I suppose, labor conditions were more favorable to them, right, in the past, where, you know, there's a surplus labor. So it's like, you know, they just keep churning, right? So if you're not happy, leave, they will find the next person will be in the door already. And so that kind of flush creates a lot of busy work. but it doesn't create value add outcomes. And those will dissipate with time.
I think that there are a lot of people who are genuinely and sincerely trying to do good. They put in a lot of effort. The challenge is that it's not an easy thing to accomplish. You know, there are a lot of things that you actually need to put in place because we are trying to change a system. Like, for example, I mean, Prof brought out the point about HR. In defense of HR, I would say that actually the top management need to decide that HR should function differently. So HR currently is working more like a compliance administrative role. But HR should be the most strategic one that they should operate differently. I mean, for example, right, when we hire people, so far I've been only impressed with a couple of HR staff that I've worked with, where they actually know what kind of person I'm trying to hire, what my role is about, and then they proactively look out for people in those roles. More often than not, they are so busy and overwhelmed with so much administrative work. So senior management has to change about what they think HR should do. It should move towards more strategic HR rather than administrative HR, which the vast majority of HR professionals are kind of boxed up to do.
I think our human resources listeners are not very happy right now. But there's one more person that also matters. You, me, the consumers, says Prof.
So one thing that we could leverage is really the thinking consumer. Because the consumer in Singapore now and globally is one who, you know, is willing to pay more for superior products, right? So recently I was in Seattle and, you know, trying to just rush work trip, trying to bring some chocolate home. And I noticed it was made in Seattle. So I went straight for it. Small little thing, it cost so much, right? But then one thing spoke to me because it was International Women's Week and it says, owned by women. And then there's a big sign that says 10% of proceeds will go to, you know, support of education of girls in, you know, disprivileged circumstance. So I bought that. So everybody got a smaller gift. I have to explain, it looks cheap, but it's not cheap, okay? But for a good cause. So I think that we have to put our money where we want, you know, development to progress, right? So if an organization is an employer of persons with special needs and disabilities, they should sing that out loud, right? And those of us who want to do the right thing and push society to grow in a certain way, we go and put our money where it counts. So I think that's the way to move forward. We can't go for just the cheapest option. And in the end, we just render the future of Singapore, you know, a more dismay outcome, right?
I think sometimes companies try to hide it. Like, they want to be humble, and then they don't talk about it. But if we, the public, doesn't know the good work that your company is doing, how are they going to support you, right?
Jonathan, actually, I have one question for you. So, I was handling employee communications in the past, and we're always torn between, are we exploiting this area? Are we hiring people of a certain type, maybe the seniors or people with disabilities, and are we exploiting them by shouting about it?
I don't think so. I think there are ways that we can do it in a different, more tasteful manner. The most important way, of course, is to get the person directly involved. So you're not talking about the person, you're letting the person talk about themselves. So it's very different from using the PWD as a poster child. You don't want that, but you want to give them that platform, the opportunity to talk about themselves, to profile themselves, and to share more. Not just about the disability that they have, but the good work that they are doing, the value that they are adding to their team or to the company.
We have talked about bosses, the consumer, HR. I asked Isaac, what do we, the workers, need to do?
The reason why stereotypes exist is because we have a gap in understanding and knowledge about people with disabilities or people who are older and whatever groups of people we're talking about. And in the absence of knowledge, our imagination is limited because what we can imagine or what they can do or what we can do is unable to go very far because we do not know them. And instead of imagining and then talking among ourselves, like Jonathan said, we got to talk to them and ask them. Many people with disabilities have very unique skills that they can contribute. Because of their disability, they have to cope differently. They have to wire their brains differently to deal with the situations. For example, for just a personal note, I'm dyslexic, and then I have a hearing impairment. And because of that, I'm quite comfortable working with complex situations where information is missing, because it's missing all the time. Anyway, so I would think that when we do not have a good understanding of people with disabilities or older workers, their needs, their contribution, their unique strengths, we could end up to become quite patronizing.
So one of the things I found when I spoke to my friends, working executives, sometimes they say, we know we have to do it. But really, when you're actually working with older people or people with mental health issues, you find that you're having to pick up the slack for them very often. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it comes back down to when we hire talent, and everyone is a talent, right? And they will bring different value, you know, proposition to the table. We are not scoping the job to match the talent that we have. And when that happens, then you have a mismatch. And with the mismatch, then of course there'll be mishaps. So that's one, right? And the second, I think we also don't spend enough on training. I mean, if you think about the people who have joined your organizations in the recent months, right? I mean, what happens? They join you and then don't know, you know, you don't know who's training them, but they are expected to be your third arm or your fourth arm, right? And then my third point is, we have a lot of us who want to be leaders, we want to be managers, we want to be ROs, right? So I think that layer has to be trained very well too. I don't have any problems because the RO takes care of everything. The RO takes care of the training, the unit cohesion, and everything then works out very nicely. So I think the reporting officers or the managers, you know, at the middle level, they really have to be empowered to raise the potential of their mentorees or their, you know, people who report to them, right? I think if we do this well, we should not have as much of an issue.
This task of customizing the job to suit the worker is actually harder than it sounds. How can we as a nation help employers to do so?
The contrast is in the nature of work in the 21st century. In the onset of industrialization, and we depended so much on the factory floor, right? That's where the mass production was the norm, and every worker just find your place in the assembly line and just slide right in and slide right out without disrupting the flow of work. But those days are gone because of, you know, technology and digitalization and so forth, right? So a lot of the work that we now do is valued for that human touch. And so if it is valued for that human touch, then it is even more critical for us to find the right human to be your touch point for whatever that role is. So very simply, right, we are in a workplace where, for example, even in a smallish unit, simple things like some are more extroverted, some are more introverted. So we place the extroverted ones in the front line because they love talking to people. And then we place the introverted ones, you know, where they don't have to deal with customer, you know, orientation that much. And of course, this is what training for managers should be, right? It should be knowing how to identify, you know, the strengths of your workforce and how to, you know, design the job scope so that each one can play up to their strengths. And where you have a job where nobody wants, then the question is, do you need a human being to do it? If all the human beings that you have don't like doing it, you know, might that be an argument for automation?
In a way, I thought if we switch track to think a bit, right, about this differently, right? Sometimes I think that we put a lot of unfair attention on people with disability or people with mental health conditions to the point that it's almost that they have to prove their worth to be able to contribute. But now if you look at it differently, I think what we are trying to do here is to build a more humanistic environment, workplace, that everybody will benefit, right? Because at some point in time, we will have a mental health condition of some sort. We will have parents who are unwell. We will need to alternative work arrangements. Everybody will benefit from a humanistic workplace that pays attention to individual needs and circumstances. By shaping and preparing our workplaces to meet this variety of needs, we can also retain and attract the kind of people who work for your organization. And that is a strength and a competitive advantage compared to your other organizations who are unable to offer the kind of environment. Just for example, I'm a small company. I like to hire students. I like to hire people who are have all kinds of caregiving responsibilities, who can work, who have the skills, but just cannot do regular hours. I found that because I took that approach, the number of people and talented people who apply to the jobs is a lot more. No, I mean, I can have a few hundred people applying for just a very small job. And I look at the kind of skills that they bring to the table. It's just amazing. And to the point that what Prof was mentioning in the beginning, right, we lose so much potential and talent who could actually contribute, but just for the fact that our workplaces are structured in such a way that is pretty unfriendly for people who are going through normal human activities in the normal human trajectory.
I just wanted to kind of reflect on what Isaac's last point was about how some of these things that are very normal, you know, I don't really want to say failings or ailments, but it's things that happen to us in the normal human life, right? Why is it being held against us by the workplace? So yeah, I completely resonate with that.
I think we have very exciting times ahead of us because transformation is not a bad word. You know, it is keeping up with times and it is our ability to pivot ourselves so that Singapore remains relevant and significant, right? And because we are such a small country, it's easier for us to do this than other larger countries and communities. So I think that having this conversation is such an important good start. Hope we talk again. And then each time we'll bring something new to the table. And we also bring good news, right? Where we can see positive change.
John, you're a person with disabilities. I didn't expect you to last the whole podcast.
That sounds like a stereotype. Don't label me.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Work Talk. A special thanks to our guests, Prof. Strong and Isaac Lim. I'm Chris Boo.
I'm Jonathan Teo.
Our producers are Teo Tong Kai, Amirul Karim. The supervising producer is Ernest Lewis.
Have a good work week.
Send your feedback to podcast@sbh.com.sg. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or within our Straits Times app. Thanks for listening.